Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and this episode is Q&A number 24, and as always, if you have questions that you want me to answer on a future Q&A episode, then send them to michael@scientifictriathlon.com or through the Facebook Messenger widget on the website scientifictriathlon.com. Before we get into today's questions, a big thanks to Roka on roka.com for sponsoring today's episode. Roka are the world leaders in wetsuits, trisuits, and other triathlon and swim apparel, as well as high-performance eyewear for triathletes and cyclists and other endurance athletes. Today, I want to talk a little bit more about their wetsuits, because that is one of the most important, gear or equipment investments that we make as triathletes. It's important to have a wetsuit that you do not get shoulder discomfort or limited mobility from. And Roka has a great way of solving that with all of their different wetsuits, from the entry level to the high end, with their arms up technology that makes sure that you have no shoulder discomfort and you have excellent mobility. All of their suits also use premium materials, premium zippers and tape, glue and thread are handmade, and they have excellent attention to detail. They also have a patent pending buoyancy profile, which is very cool. So they have a 1-3-5 buoyancy profile, meaning 1.5 millimeter of neoprene up top and 3 millimeters at the core and 5 millimeters in the hips and legs. And this will put you in the fastest possible body position in the water. If you're looking for a new wetsuit for your triathlon race season, look no further than Roka. Go to roka.com and use the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps, to get 20% off your entire order. And of course, that promo code is also valid for any other thing that you might want to get from Roka, including sunglasses or swim skins or buoyancy shorts or anything along those lines. Go to roka.com and that promo code, as I said, will give you 20% off your entire order. All right, so let's get into today's questions, starting with Scott from Spokane, Washington. Scott writes, I have a question about where to place my runs for Ironman training. In the past, I have done 3 runs a week, 1 interval or hill training run, 1 tempo run, and 1 long run. I have always done my long run the day after my long ride, for example, 112 miles on Saturday and a 20-mile run on Sunday. What if I did my long run earlier in the week so I could do a double long bike rides on Saturday and Sunday? Could this have a better outcome? So thanks for the question, Scott. There's no right or wrong answer here, but what you suggest is definitely worth trying, in my opinion. I do think that having a double long bike weekend, that sort of concept is something that can be very effective. I've done it myself quite a lot and seen great results from it. But ultimately, you will need to monitor how you feel and how you respond to it to see if it's right for you. And also, that's not just about the weekend, but of course, how does this impact the rest of the training that you do during the weekdays? But there are many potential benefits, and some of them are, for example, you can do your long run on fresher legs compared to having a 112 mile ride in your legs. So that could be beneficial physiologically for sure, but even more so, I think, from a psychological and also injury prevention perspective, this is a big positive for having that long run midweek. And for the bike, stacking 2 long rides back to back, it sort of means that when you start that Sunday bike ride, it's as if you had already biked for 1 hour, or I don't know if 1 hour is the right amount, but you know what I mean. I guess you're not starting from completely fresh. You're starting as if you've already done something, which is positive because it can elicit stronger adaptations. So that's something that I think is very beneficial, of that sort of back-to-back concept. And in ultra running, having a back-to-back long run is something that has become very popular because it's extremely effective. So rather than going out and doing a 40-mile run on one day per week, many ultra runners, they do back-to-back, let's say 20-mile runs on a Saturday and Sunday for that same reason. When I've done personally done these double bike weekends to make sure that I get in my quality on the bike as well, because I might do one or zero quality bikes during the weekday, depending on how I structure my week. I have tended to do some quality in the early part of the Saturday ride. So I might do threshold intervals or VO2 max intervals during the first hour or hour and a half of the bike, and then finish off that that ride as just easy endurance riding, but keep going for a long time. So I get in a 3 to 4 hour ride, but that contains intensity as that first part. And then the Sunday ride, of course, is also just an easy long, slow distance ride. One thing that you also might want to consider, and or that you have to consider, is about the running. Because if you are going to be doing that long run midweek, then also having an interval run and a tempo run, and all of them, I assume, on weekdays, that might be a bit too much. So you'll definitely need to monitor this at the very least. But you might be better off just off the bat scratching one of those other runs, and or making it no intensity is what I want to say. So, for example, doing just the interval run and the long run, and then the third run that you do would be just an easy endurance run. Potentially you could do it on hilly terrain, you mentioned hills there, and that's great, but just keep the effort very low. So thanks for your question, Scott. The next question we have is from Josh, also in the United States. He writes, I am 38 years old and a former collegiate swimmer. I was an above average collegiate swimmer, though certainly not elite. After graduating, I became a weekend warrior, and my primary sport of choice became ultimate frisbee. I played that regularly until my 36th year, when I suffered a significant knee injury. I underwent surgeries, many months on crutches, and over a year of rehab. And as part of that, I re-engaged with my swimming roots and eventually added cycling and running this past summer, which led me to triathlon. And I am now focusing on participating in the Olympic distance nationals here this coming August. So a few questions for you. One, while my days of heavy ultimate frisbee play are now over, I'm still very connected to the community of players and play in some low-key local leagues. I'm wondering what, if any, endurance benefit I gain from this, or more generally, what benefit do field sports like soccer, lacrosse, rugby, etc. offer to an endurance athlete? Does running 3 or 4 miles over the course of 90 minutes with lots of short sprints as well as lots of jogging and standing mean anything to triathlon performance? So, by the way, I should have mentioned at the start of this episode, I'm trying to get quite a lot of questions done in today's episode as an experiment, so I'm not going to be quite as detailed with all of my answers. So this one is one of those short and sweet answers. But my answer here is that compared to sitting on the couch, playing ultimate frisbee or other field sports means a lot. It at least means something. It's very good and very preferable to sitting on the couch. Compared to, for triathlon performance, from triathlon or endurance sports perspective, compared to doing a structured swim, bike, or run workout as part of a structured training plan, is definitely much less effective. It is there's a significant difference there. So I guess I would say that it falls right in the middle of that. On the one end, you have just sitting on the couch doing nothing, and on the other end of the spectrum, you have a structured, well-planned session, which might be just an easy session, but it's it all has a purpose, which is part of a structured plan. So you have those two on different ends of the spectrum, and smack down in the middle you have playing field sports. That would be my take. Question number two here. So again, Josh keeps writing, I've logged thousands of training hours earlier in life swimming, and therefore have very good technique as compared to most triathletes. My focus in triathlon has been mostly on cycling and running. Thus far, I've not swum more than 3 times in a week for a maximum weekly total of around 4,500 meters. I've been a top 5 swimmer in every triathlon I've competed so far, and then watched the field pass me by in the other disciplines. I'm wondering if there's really any benefit in increasing my swimming. Knowing my body as a swimmer, I believe I would need to put in at least a triple the amount of what I'm doing now to see even marginal gains, like 2 to 3 seconds per 100 meters. And I'm not sure it would be worth it. With a focus on running the last few months, I dropped my per per mile pace by over 90 seconds per mile from the start of autumn. I think I should continue to focus on running and cycling and not put in any additional time in the water, but I'm wondering what you might say. Yeah, I definitely agree here. The key for me is that you say that you know your body as a swimmer and you know how you respond to training. And this is an important message to everybody listening. We need to get to know our bodies, know how they work and how they respond to training. And then we can make much better decisions, informed decisions in training. So Josh, I do agree with you here that if you keep getting past on the bike and the run, definitely focus on those two and do the minimum swimming required to maintain your current level on swimming, and that will be good enough. And I would say the same thing would apply even if we work in some margin in your estimates. Let's say that you could actually improve by 4 to 5 seconds per 100 by just doubling your swim volume rather than improving by 2 to 3 seconds by tripling it. Then still that 4 to 5 seconds would mean 1 minute, 1 minute, 15 seconds over an Olympic distance. But and for doubling the training volume swimming, then I think that you will get much better gains if you focus on running and cycling, as you suggest. Question number 3 here from Josh. Josh is, additionally, my family recently welcomed a new member. And so I have 2 young children at home. I know that getting ready for Olympic distance racing means putting in some long runs and rides, but committing the time necessary may not be possible. I usually don't have more than 45 minutes at any one time for training, but I often have 2 of these blocks in my day. Knowing that my rides and runs have to be short, how can I get the best bang for my training buck? I'm anticipating being able to get about 1 90-minute session every other week this spring-summer, but the majority of training opportunities will be kept at around 45 minutes. Should I still aim for that magical 80-20 distribution, or should I look to add more high intensity, especially on the bike, with my limited training opportunities? So Josh, great question. First of all, I would say definitely try to make the most of those 90-minute windows whenever you do have them, and use them to get in a long bike or a long run. Second, there's nothing magical about the 80-20 distribution, in my humble opinion. But it serves, I guess, as a nice framework and some guideline about how to think, but nothing magical at all about it. But to get more specific and answer your question, what you do depends to some extent on your total training volume, I would say here. For example, if you train 45 minutes per day, 2 times per day, every single day of the week, then that's 10 and a half hours per week. So that's already a fairly significant volume, definitely high enough that you need to do quite a lot of very easy training. If you train a bit less, so let's say you train 10 times per week, 10 times 45 minutes is 7.5 hours, then you can definitely have a higher proportion of your workouts have intensity to them, but you still should definitely not have hard workouts all the time. So as a general rule of thumb, I really think that for most of us, having 2 hard bikes, 2 hard runs and 2 hard swims, so this means 2 workouts per discipline where you have a main set which has which is intense to it. I think that is the maximum number of hard workouts that it makes sense doing. You might get away with more, but I don't really think that that is going to add much benefit, but it's going to add a lot more risk. So if you, for example, in that latter example where you have 10 workouts per week, 7.5 hours total, if we assume 10 times 45 minutes, then you would still have 4 completely easy workouts in that week, and then those 6 workouts that might have intensity to them. But by the way, this does not mean 2 plus 2 plus 2 that I talked about. I said that is the maximum number of hard workouts that I think that it makes sense doing, but it doesn't mean that you should be doing as many. This comes down to the individual very much, so you need to consider your history and perhaps you being newer to the sport and also having done surgeries. Especially on the run, I would be careful. So maybe just do 1 hard run per week might be a better option for you. And it definitely doesn't mean that everybody should do 2 hard bikes, 2 hard runs, and 2 hard too hard. What did I say? Too hard bikes, runs, and swims. Personally, for example, I'm currently running six times per week, but only one of those runs is hard. So that's one example. But if you are limited to those 45-minute windows, and we assume that you train, let's say, for example, three swims per week, three or four bikes, and three or four runs per week. So that's 10 to 11 workouts per week. Then try to include intensity in two swims per week and two bikes per week, and perhaps starting with just one run per week. And if everything goes well, then you can add intensity to a second run as well and see how it works. But for the remainder of the workouts, even if they are just, in air quotes, 45 minutes, keep them very easy. It doesn't matter that they are short. Doing them at a moderate intensity won't make them any more effective than doing them at an easy intensity, but it can derail the adaptations that you get from those harder workouts later. And even doing them somewhat easy won't make them any more effective than doing them very easy. Don't try to push your easy pace. Rather, try to make the same easy pace that you start with feel easier and easier and easier, and go at a lower and lower and lower heart rate. That would be my suggestion here. Hope this helps, and thanks so much for your questions, Josh. The next question here is from Ben Rowlands in Australia, who writes, "Hi Michael, greetings from Australia. I was wondering if the respiratory system can be trained for performance gains. I occasionally suffer from stitches during races and was wondering if there is any scientific research regarding this and how to prevent it from happening. There seems to be plenty of products out there that suggest respiratory performance can be improved by using gear such as nasal strips or rhinoid turbine. I have to be honest, I'm not even sure what that is, but I'll look it up after. And also equipment like the Power Breathe snorkel and hypoxic training with an elevation mask. Do you think there are any gains to be made by using any of these products? Also, what is your take on incorporating nasal breathing during training sessions and breathing techniques and rhythms during exercise in general? Keep up the great informative podcast." Okay, so thanks, Ben. Those are some really interesting questions. If we start with tackling the respiratory system, this is something that I recently got some specifics insights into while taking the HIIT science course that I talked about before. So shout out to Paul Larson and Martin Boucher for putting together a great course. But the respiratory system is a component of the cardiopulmonary system. So essentially, we want to get oxygen from the air that we inhale into our bloodstream and then pump out a lot of oxygen-carrying blood from our hearts to our working muscles so that the muscles can extract that oxygen from the blood. And what we know from science that I just learned in that HIIT science course a few weeks ago is that in this whole system, the respiratory system, so how much air you can inhale, that is almost never a limiter in the overall system. It's always something else like stroke volume or oxygen carrying capacity of the blood or something like that. So the respiratory system is always strong enough to contribute with enough air and then it comes down to other factors, how much oxygen you can get into your working muscles. There might be some exceptions, but those would be medical conditions. So with this in mind, using products to train the respiratory system does not make sense, in my opinion. Now, you mentioned their hypoxic training with an altitude mask. That's a different thing. That's not training the respiratory system. That simulates altitude, but still, from what I understand about altitude training and simulated altitude training, if you use that mask to do, let's say you train for an hour with it, or maybe you even train for 2 hours or two times 1 hours during the day, then you still have 22 hours that you are at sea level, and you're not going to get any benefits from training with that oxygen mask at all. Now, there might be a case there for then if you also spend 14 hours per day in your altitude tent, then it might start working. But I think you can already understand that I would not really recommend this, and not even for professional athletes. And then you might also argue, and this is not my area of expertise, so I should probably interview somebody about it, but I think that what would be more effective would be to just spend those 14 or 16 hours per day in the altitude tent and then actually train without that oxygen or altitude mask. So that's specific to the altitude mask, I guess. But I guess this answers that first part of your question. As for nasal breathing, I found myself reading an interesting Twitter discussion a month or so ago, and it was initiated by Steve Magness, who is a great running coach. I'm just going to open it up here, by the way. He's a great running coach and the author of The Science of Running book. So, oh, come on. I can't get the link to open up, so this is taking a while. But he was writing, here we go, just a second. Witness two myths that won't die in the athletic world this morning. A soccer team yelling, one, breathe through your nose, not your mouth. And two, put hands over your head to get air in after hard running. Both are nonsense. And then there are tons of discussions here after that, but essentially the sum of it is that there are plenty of really knowledgeable people commenting here as well, and a great discussion. And I'll link to this tweet discussion in the episode description. But the sum of it is that it really doesn't make sense to focus on nasal breathing in training at all. So it's all about getting oxygen into your blood. And if you can do that, then go ahead and breathe through your ears as well as your mouth and any other bodily orifice that you can think of that we can leave unmentioned for now. But if you could do that, then that would only be an additional benefit rather than trying to restrict your breathing. And finally, for stitches, so we don't really know from science the mechanics behind them or how to prevent them, because there isn't a lot of research on them. I found a review article from 2015, and they noted that after a few studies in the 40s and 50s, there was a nearly 50-year gap in research on side stitches. So it's not something that's been extensively researched. But what I found is that the basic things that we do know is that, well, we don't know the exact mechanisms and we don't know how to prevent them. We do know that they are more common in younger people. And we also know that athletes of all ability levels get side stitches, although elite athletes get them less often. But when they do, they get them just as severely as more amateur level athletes do. So that's for stitches. I'll link to that review article as well if you want to dig deeper on your own. The final question for Jay is from Tom from Belgium, who writes, I have a question that could be interesting to answer in the Q&A. What are the best ways to determine aerobic capacity or VO2 max, and which training forms can increase it? Thanks for all the good work. Thanks for the question, Tom. I have to say I love this question and these types of questions, because this is a question that really hones in on the big, important stuff and the things that really matter and make a big, big difference. To clarify, all the questions that I select for any Q&A episode are all good, because I want them to be beneficial for the listeners, of course. So I don't select questions that are not good questions, to be honest, for various reasons. I don't select them for the podcast. But then there are like a spectrum of really good questions, and this one is like the Jan Frodeno of questions, because it's so excellent in that it really focuses in on one of the big priorities of endurance sports: aerobic capacity. So we could talk for hours about this, but I'll keep it short and simple. The best ways to determine aerobic capacity would be a well-equipped lab with high-end VO2 max test equipment. And now I don't know personally which brands or types of equipment are the best or most accurate. I just know that there is quite a variance between different equipment. So it's worth asking the lab staff if their equipment is high-end or how it compares to the best in the industry equipment, and just hope for an honest answer when you decide which lab to go to. A second option, on the bike specifically at least, is to do a critical power test and analyze it with the software called Inside. So I discussed that in my interview with Sebastian Weber in episode 169. I'll link to that as well. And I'll link to, I do this testing protocol. So this is something that you can do your testing at home, send in a power file and get it analyzed. And this sort of testing has been validated to be of similar accuracy to lab grade testing. But that's only for the bike, for now. And another way is to do a simple field test. You won't be able to estimate your VO2 max, but you can estimate your power or pace at VO2 max, which at the end of the day is perhaps more important than the VO2 max itself, because it will allow you to plan your training effectively and execute your training effectively. So that would be to simply do just a 5 or 6 minute time trial. And the power or pace that you can hold for that duration, whether it's swimming, biking or running, that should be reasonably close to your to what your power associated with VO2 max or your pace associated with VO2 max is. If you use, again, for the bike only, by the way, the WKO software, that does give a good estimate of your VO2 max, both power and the absolute and relative VO2 max in oxygen per liter per minute. And that is based on your real world power data on the bike. So it's pretty good. It's not, as all estimates, it's not exact, but it's pretty good. Then there are tons of apps that estimate VO2 max, and your Garmin watch, probably other GPS watches do it. I'm unfamiliar with most of them except the Garmin, because I use a Garmin watch myself. I think it's very hit and miss with Garmin. Some people find that they are very accurate and they have actually verified this with lab testing, but for others it's completely off course. So I would definitely not rely on these. As for other apps or similar, there may be good apps that do a better, good job of estimating it out there. I'm just not familiar with them. And honestly, if you want to do estimate your VO2 max in the simplest and cheapest way possible, then that is still very useful, then doing a 5 or 6 minute time trial is by far the best way to go. Again, you won't be able to extract your VO2 max necessarily from that, but your power or pace associated with VO2 max, which is more interesting almost than the VO2 max itself. Now, briefly about how to train to improve it. You have two pathways or two choices, and I think that doing both of them is the best way to go. So they're not mutually exclusive. It's definitely not one or the other. They work in concert with each other. So we have volume or intensity. And for volume, I would rate this as the highest. I think volume is definitely very underrated for endurance athletes today. Not for professionals, definitely not, but for age groupers, I think it is. Maybe CrossFit has something to do with it, but who knows. But terms like quality over quantity are thrown around quite carelessly. I'm sure I've done it as well quite a few times, but the truth is that to optimize your endurance potential, you need a certain training volume. You need quite a big training volume if we're really talking about reaching your full potential. And you just won't be able to achieve that without a significant volume. And that's, of course, okay. We have jobs, families, etc., that may make reaching our full potential impossible. And that's not something that we're striving for. We're just striving to be the best that we can be with the time that we have to commit to training. And then, of course, that's what we have to do. We have to work with what we have. But I think it is important to be very aware of the fact that if you can increase training volume, then that is going to be a benefit in most cases. Of course, I'm not talking about cutting out sleep to increase training volume or stupid things like that, but I'm talking about doing it in a sensible way. So if you can do that, and being aware that this will have a positive effect, that is very important for athletes to not fall in the trap of doing too much, too hard training, but then just not consistently getting in a decent training volume. Intensity can never replace volume. I think, again, you need both to act together to maximize your improvements in VO2 max, in aerobic capacity. When it comes to intensity, there is quite a lot of research, but there, so we know quite a lot. And again, I'm using quite a lot of referencing heat science here quite a lot because I'm just going through that course and they've done all the work for me here. There are some things that we don't know, but what one of the main things that seems to be quite clear is that a key factor in improving VO2 max is to accumulate a high amount of time spent at or close to your VO2 max in a single training session. So that wouldn't be like doing 1 5-minute interval every single day of the week, but rather doing 4 of them in one session, for example. The types of intervals that work best for this purpose, for spending time at or close to VO2 max, also seems quite clear. And it is to do intervals that are in the range of typically 2 to 4, maybe 2 to 5 minutes. So trying to accumulate 15 to 20 minutes of work, and I would definitely, as soon as an athlete is advanced enough, I would definitely err on that higher side. So trying to accumulate close to 20 minutes or even more in some cases, 25, of work at that very high intensity using these sorts of 2 to 4 minute intervals. That is my number one strategy for sure when it comes to using intensity to improve aerobic capacity. So example workouts for this might be 10 times 2 minutes best effort, essentially, and 2 minutes active recovery, easy active recovery, but still active recovery. Or it might be 6 times 3 minutes on, 3 minutes off, or 4 to 5 times 4 minutes on, 4 minutes off, or 3 minutes on, 3 minutes off. You might not need for 4 minute intervals, 3 minute recoveries might be preferable, but that's really splitting hairs, essentially. So I think that you get the point here, that those sort of 2 to 4 minute intervals, getting close to 20 minutes, that is in a solid traditional VO2 max session, that is the best way when it comes to intensity. Now, other types of intensities also do work, and we know this from research. Steven Seiler's recent work with finding that 8-minute intervals work great, so those would probably be somewhere in between your anaerobic threshold and your VO2 max intensity. But what I would say that it gets a bit more individual, and this is purely from an anecdotal perspective. I don't have any sources or references for this. So if you ask for the best intensity, I would definitely prioritize the VO2 max intervals first. But then if somehow the athlete doesn't react well to that type of training, then that's when you might want to add in some different sort of intensity to see if that helps. Just a little bit of science here as well. Why you need both volume and intensity to improve VO2 max. A lot of the improvements that we do get in aerobic capacity, they come from a switch that is called PGC1-alpha. PGC1-alpha is basically a regulator protein that, among other things, is heavily involved in helping your cells build more and stronger mitochondria, which in simple terms are the energy plants, the power factories of the cells. And this PGC1-alpha switch can be activated, if you want to call it that, by two main pathways in endurance sports. And those are the AMPK pathway, which is more associated with high intensity interval training, and then the calcium pathway, which is more associated with just repeated low force muscle contractions. So like long slow distance is the perfect example of this, just a lot of muscle contractions, not of any great intensity, very low intensity in fact, but that really activates that calcium pathway and in turn switches on that PGC1-alpha regulator. So this is a very big simplification of things, of course, but I think it's already complex enough, so let's not make it any more complex than that. But either way, we want to, like, increasing mitochondrial biogenesis, that's important. Therefore, we want that PGC1-alpha signaling, and to maximize that PGC1-alpha signaling, we can therefore infer that we need to do both high-intensity training and steady training, long slow distance training, to use both of those pathways, the calcium pathway and the AMPK pathway, to get the most out of the PGC1-alpha switch. All right, so thank you again for your question, Tom. I hope that answers it. And before we close off this episode, I do have one house cleaning item. For those of you who bought the intermediate Ironman training plan on Training Peaks around about a month or so ago, the PDF version of that is now available. So if you recall, that was only available on Training Peaks at the time, but now the PDF is available and you can have free access to that if you want it. Just email me, michael@scientifictriathlon.com. Use some good subject line, like, for example, Ironman plan PDF, and I'll send you access to that PDF version. Big thanks to Roka for sponsoring this episode. If you're on the lookout for wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance sunglasses or other eyewear, all of those sorts of things, look no further than Roka, that you can find on roka.com. They ship in the US, but now also ship from the UK and EU, so no customs or duties, which is great, great, great news for all of us. And you can get 20% off your entire order with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.